You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In its unanimous June 2008 decision about freedom of expression, the Supreme Court of Canada stated, "The law must accommodate commentators, such as the satirist or the cartoonist, who exercise a democratic right to poke fun at those who huff and puff in the public arena." Despite such strong statements by the highest court in the land, the law often appears to be more on the side of those who seek to stifle the expressions of politically active satirists, artists, and citizens. Meaningful and effective criticism of powerful institutions is usually put on a very short leash in the arena of public discussion. This week, the Seriously Free Speech Committee brought together four speakers from a variety of backgrounds to address these issues in a public forum. Red Eye was there to record the presentations, and we're going to broadcast those now. The first speaker was Michael Vaughan. She is Policy Director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. Michael Vaughan spoke on how strategic lawsuits against public participation are used to try and intimidate citizens into silence and inaction. Here is Michael Vaughan.
SLAPs are strategic lawsuits against public participation. That is, when big resources, a person or group with wealth, power, and legal resources brings a frivolous or dubious lawsuit against little resources, generally the citizens who have been criticizing big resources, in order to shut down those critics, of course, and intimidate others from doing so. The merits of the lawsuit are absolutely unimportant. The lawsuit can be completely ridiculous and yet achieve its ends. Defending a lawsuit brought by a very powerful litigant is enormously costly in time, money, and emotional resources. A survey conducted by the Canadian Lawyers magazine recently reported that the going rate in Canada for a two-day civil trial is $25,220 change. It is therefore not an exaggeration to say that a threat of such a lawsuit can rise to the level of threatening one's very own well-being. And their consequences for democratic process are, of course, equally dire. So, here's the subject of my talk, the two big points. We urgently need laws that protect against slaps. And while we're at it, let us reform the laws of defamation. Let me unpack those a little bit. Governments. Slaps have long been a tool of corporate intimidation, but just recently we've seen a little spat of governments trying to get in on the action. In 2005, for example, Donald Page, a retired engineer and civil servant, was sued for defamation by the Ontario Township of Montague for making a complaint against the local fire department to the Ontario Fire Marshal. Yes? Bring the wax out of your ears. That's right. You heard that. Sued for defamation for a complaint to the fire marshal about, among other things, inadequate training of the volunteer fire department. Once more, complaining about a fire safety issue to the organization statutorily mandated to receive complaints about fire safety issues. The notion is so patently outrageous that it is almost funny. It's not quite the parrot sketch, but we are definitely sphering into Monty Python territory when that can be the grounds for a defamation claim. You will, of course, heave a huge sigh of relief to know that Mr. Page was not successfully prosecuted for this in the town of Montague's claim for $50,000 in damages against him. But what did it cost Mr. Page in real terms, to defend himself against this suit? And do the citizens of Montague now think twice, three times, or four times before they speak out about issues of public importance? We certainly know that the legal precedence of that case was not enough to prevent the city of Powell River from trying their hand at exactly the same thing. Last year, the city of Powell River threatened to sue some local citizens for defamation over statements that they had made concerning the utilization of public funds, election proceedings, and conflict of interest. it really is hard to conceive of a libel chill that is chillier or more corrosive of democratic principles than a government suing citizens for criticizing the government. On our association's reading of the relevant case law, and that includes the Donald Page case, we say there can be no legitimate action for defamation on the part of any government of Canada. And we wrote to the city of Powell River to say so, and to share some of the pithier judicial pronouncements on the subject. One of my personal favorites is from Mr. Justice Corbett in the Halton Hills case. I'm quoting from him. When a government is criticized, its recourse is to the public domain, not the courts. The government may not imprison or fine or sue those who criticize it. The government may respond. This is fundamental. Litigation is a form of force, and the government must not silence its critics by force. Unquote. Litigation is a form of force. So if a illegitimate lawsuit is threatened by the government to silence its critics, is there any remedy? Yes. There is a possibility that the citizens so threatened might bring an action in constitutional tort. We have recent case law that affirms that damages can be awarded for charter breaches. But this is, of course, all surgery to try to repair the bodies after the train wreck, right? What we need is an ability to prevent the train wrecks from happening in the first place. This is a hugely urgent need. Various examples of slaps are going to be vetted here today. We may have some discussion about some others, but I'm just going to use one example that is very, very timely, and that's the ASIN case. You may have heard about this on the CBC. It got a lot of uptake in the media. Jack ASIN is a retired Justice of the Peace. He and his wife, Judy, live in Vernon, B.C., in an area of Vernon where water and sewer services are provided by a private utility. Many residents had complaints about this private utility, but only a very few spoke out. The owner of the private utility was very free in threats of lawsuits against his critics. As cited in a letter from a strata plan to the Land and Water Regulatory Body, there is considerable fear in this community over the power of this utility. Individual property owners are fearful of voicing their concerns or objections out of a fear of retribution, which typically involves considerable legal costs. In fact, the owner of the private utility did end up suing Jack and various others for defamation. For, among other things, letters of complaints to the regulatory body and petitions. So again, echoes of the Donald Page scenario. Which is, of course, bad enough. But we don't actually get into full-on Kafka land with this until we get this piece of the story. The utility owner sent a private detective to the ASIN's house to misrepresent himself as a prospective buyer of property, interested in moving into the neighborhood. So he was sent to get Jack to say something against the utility owner and to secretly record that conversation. That was one of the grounds of defamation that was brought. Now, at trial, the ASIN successfully defended themselves on every charge of defamation, much to their credit. And the utility owner appealed. And at the BC Court of Appeal, they, in their wisdom, upheld the lower court findings in all regards with the exception of the piece I've just told you. They did find that there was defamation in the surreptitiously recorded conversation of a private detective who had been invited in on the basis of fraudulent misrepresentation, so in my reading was trespassing, to set Jack up to make comments on the private utilities and its owner by pretending that he was moving into the area. So one more time in slow motion. Jack is successfully sued for defamation for a statement he makes in his own living room to a person who is purporting to be a prospective neighbor. I wish I were making that up, but I'm not. I happen to know the ASINs who contacted our association, and that they are very highly motivated to see that nothing like this happens to anyone ever again. Which, of course, begs the question, what can be done? Well, sadly, the obvious place to begin looks none too promising. In his comments on this story, the Attorney General of British Columbia insisted that courts are already well equipped to deal with vexatious litigation, and that he did not see any need for statutory protections against slaps. On what possible basis he could have come to such a conclusion, we do not know. What precisely is this effective mechanism, and why did it fail the ASINs and everybody else so very badly? We do know that the AG's stance on this entirely echoes the reasons why his government gave for repealing the previous government's legislative protections against slaps. Because, you see, to add insult to injury, we had such a law. For a very brief time, we had a statute called the Protection of Public Participation Act. And it was the product of extensive debate and consultation, our organization among other groups. And the current government killed it as soon as it could, in the dead of summer. And the AG of that day also argued exactly as the AG of present does, that it really isn't needed, procedural rules are in place that will dismiss frivolous lawsuits. What the AG then and now fail to add on to that is that a review of these rules and the case law that applies to them will show clearly that they are of virtually no assistance to any defendant in a slap suit. Of course we need anti-slap laws. The evidence is mounting up all around us. Many other jurisdictions have seen this and met the needs, and you know there is something seriously amiss in this province when states like Texas and Utah are way ahead of us on this one. As not exactly bastions of liberal idealism. Anti-slap laws try to prevent slaps by presenting some disincentives to dissuade parties from bringing slaps in the first place. And they also try to sort out, at a very preliminary stage, legitimate claims from illegitimate claims and to minimize the financial burden on defendants. So, for example, a slap law can, if a defendant can show that their speech, which is in question in this defamation suit, falls within a certain protected category of communications, the onus then shifts to the plaintiff to prove that the lawsuit is brought legitimately. That's one example of what a provision in an anti-slap law could look like. And if the question of the lawsuit's legitimacy cannot be determined at a very early stage in the proceedings, then there could be another provision where the judge has the flexibility to advance or interim costs to the defendant who would otherwise not be in a financial position to defend themselves. So these are just examples of what anti-slap legislation could look like. And I say, I'm not inventing these. This is what our anti-slap legislation did look like. While we're at it, as I say, the defamation laws seriously need to be overhauled. They are unintelligible to the average person. I'm going to make it. They're unintelligible to the average person. They are currently unintelligible, I suggest, to the average lawyer. The BCCLA is not alone in calling for reforms to defamation laws. We say that the laws must take as their starting point freedom of expression, and that the categories of qualified privilege and fair comment should be greatly expanded to reflect that necessary starting point. Damages could be reduced to nominal levels, except where the income of the plaintiff has been impacted and that can be demonstrated. So we're looking at actual damages, not the reputation damages that are kind of the standard in defamation laws. And these, as I say, are just examples of reforms that have long been called for. All kinds of things could be done if there were the political will to do them. And there are many speakers who are going to discuss this. So let me just end by making an observation that I don't think has been made in this realm before. As I noted previously, it is the legal opinion of our association that the government is prohibited from suing its citizens for criticism. And not only would such a suit fail, but the citizen might have recourse to charter damages. One of the trickier aspects of constitutional law currently is trying to keep our eye on this moving target of what is government? What is government now? Privatization mania on the part of many governments has made the question of what is government a $64 question in many charter challenges. Attempted slaps by government are mercifully rare. But I'm going to suggest that I happen to know more than one slap in this province that has been brought by a corporation that provides outsourced or privatized services that used to be clearly government. We know that anti-slap laws that were repealed by the government were supported by a broad range of civil libertarian, environmental groups, Union of BC Municipalities, etc. I think we might make certain educated surmises about what and whose interests the government was choosing to protect in repealing those slap protections. To recall the words of Mr. Justice Corbett, litigation is a form of force. If the government is precluded from using such force, the private sector most certainly is not in the current state. And I think that the need to protect citizens who are speaking out in the public forum is even more urgent in light of the shifting sands of what constitutes government for the purposes of charter protection.
That was Michael Vaughan. She is policy director for the BC Civil Liberties Association. She was speaking this week at a forum titled Freedom of Speech Under Siege. The next speaker at the forum was Gordon Murray. Gordon is co-creator of the Vancouver Sun parody, which targeted the strong pro-Israeli bias in Canwest Global's coverage of the Middle East. And he himself is now the target of a slap suit launched by Canwest. Here is Gordon Murray.
A New York Supreme Court judge said that slap suits, short of a gun to the head, a greater threat to freedom of expression can be scarcely imagined. So that's what's at stake here, is freedom of expression in Canada. And I want to first give a little bit of background of why we did this parody. And then I'll talk a little bit about what the reaction was to it, and where the current situation is of the court case. So to start off with, one of the reasons that we did this parody, as Brian mentioned, is because of media concentration in Canada. Canada is one of the most concentrated media markets in the G8. There's basically three or four companies that control virtually all or the majority of the mainstream media in Canada. And it's even worse than that, because within those three or four companies, that sounds like choice. There's three or four different places you can go for your news. But in fact, within these, there's kind of mini monopolies, because a lot of regions and types of media are actually dominated by one company. So, for example, radio is dominated by Corus. Newspapers are dominated by Canwest. TV is dominated by CTV. So there's concentrations within concentrations. And specifically in BC, the concentration is much worse. Although Canwest controls almost 50% of the daily newspaper circulation in Canada, it controls 84% of the daily newspaper circulation in BC, and 100% in Vancouver, where it owns the Vancouver Sun, the Vancouver Province, and it also owns a whole string of weekly newspapers, including the North Shore News, the Vancouver Courier, the Now community chain, overall 12 community papers as well as the main dailies in Vancouver. It also controls Global TV, or owns Global TV, which has by far the market-leading newscast in Vancouver. It also controls Czech TV in Victoria, and also the Times Colonist there. So Canadian Press has estimated that in Vancouver, Canwest controls 70% of the news market. So they're more than just a leader. It's a monopolistic type of position. They set the agenda. They basically decide what's news, and the rest follow. And speaking of news, I don't want to say that this is good news, but I thought I'd start out on a note since we're talking about Cannes West. As you might have been reading the news recently and noticed that they lost $33 million in their last quarter. They had to write down their goodwill by $1 billion last year. Their credit line has been cut from $300 million to $100 million by their bankers because they're in danger of violating the covenants that those loans are based on. And as a result, Cannes West has taken some measures to try and deal with their financial situation, including cutting over 800 jobs in the last year, which is going to mean that the news that Cannes West produce is more wire service and less local news, less reporters, less information, more Hollywood gossip, and so on and so forth. However, the situation has become so dire now that cutting employees isn't enough. A memo surfaced that they are cutting back on muffins at meetings. And they're asking people to restrict the number of photocopies that they make, or at least copy double-sided. So they're canceling all kinds of things like, dare I say, the Enlightened Leadership Sessions and the Leadership Forum that are organized by Cannes West for their employees. And I just want to quote from this memo because it has to be heard to be believed. This is Cannes West's recent memo. Just think, if every employee could save $1,000, the collective savings would amount to $10 million. Your involvement, support, and hard work to maximize our cost-saving initiatives are sincerely appreciated. Yours, Dennis Kulski, President and CEO, Cannes West Publishing. Well, apparently, they might be able to save $10 million by cutting the muffins from meetings, but somehow frivolous slap suits that could cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars aren't on the table for cuts. I'm not sure quite where their priorities lie, but that's kind of an indication for you. So I've talked about media concentration and obviously Cannes West's view of the way a media corporation is run. But what does media concentration mean for those of us who want to know what's happening in the world? Well, having one corporation control a large portion of the news in Vancouver does have a significant impact on what we hear about the world. There's a lot of things that Cannes West has a particular agenda about. Tonight I'm going to talk about Israel and Palestine. Probably most of you know that the founder of Cannes West, Izzy Asper, in 2003 said that we are the strongest supporter of Israel and Canada. But that kind of anecdotal information doesn't tell the real depth of their bias. There was a study done in Toronto by the Near East Culture and Educational Foundation that looked at the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and the Cannes West flagship, the National Post, on their coverage of Palestine and Israel. And they looked at all of the stories that those newspapers printed during 2004. And they looked at the headlines and first paragraphs of those stories, because that's what most people read and that's where people get the sense of a story. And they found that there was bias in all of these publications, all of Canada's national publications. And one of the things they looked at specifically was the reporting of deaths of children. One way that bias can come out is by portraying one side as the victim in a conflict, one side as the victim. And so what happened with deaths of children was that the deaths of Israeli children were much more likely to be reported than the deaths of Palestinian children. So that we got the sense that Israel is the victim. And the Globe and Mail didn't do a great job. They were biased. They were reporting Israeli children's deaths at four times the rate of Palestinian children's deaths in 2004. And actually, the Toronto Star, which is considered a liberal newspaper, was even worse. They were reporting Israeli children's deaths at eight times the rate. They were eight times more likely to report an Israeli child's death than a Palestinian child's death during 2004. But the National Post, what you can you say? They're in a class by themselves. They were 89 times more likely to report an Israeli child's death than a Palestinian child's death. So they gave a sense that four times as many Israeli children had been killed in 2004 than Palestinian children, when in fact, B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, went and investigated and found that in fact 22 times as many Palestinian children were killed as Israeli children. So that's the kind of bias that you can find in the media. I just want to give one more example. A more recent one that you might be aware of. January 6, 2009, during the assault on Gaza, Israel tanks and warplanes shelled two UN schools and killed 44 Palestinians. January 7th, you think you might be able to find out something about that story in your local newspaper. Vancouver Sun, your paper of record, first page. Rivers could flood, officials warn. So we're not talking about dog bites man story. We're not even talking about man bites dog story. We're talking about dog could bite man story. And that's the headline. Nothing, no mention of Gaza on the front page. So then we go to the Canada and the World section. The only mention is Gaza ceasefire plan gains traction on page B1, Canada and World. B2 nothing, B3 nothing, B4 nothing, B5 nothing, B6. The story of the shelling of UN schools, the headline is pressure mounts for ceasefire. So that gives you an idea why you may not know, or your friends or your family may not know, what's going on in Israel and Palestine and Gaza in Vancouver. And that's why we produced this parody, because we found that the coverage was so biased and the media concentration so great. We couldn't write an op-ed for The Sun, obviously, but there's no other paper to write an op-ed for. So we decided to produce a parody of the Vancouver Sun, ridiculing their biased coverage. The reaction to our parody, Brian alluded to, CanWest launched a lawsuit against Mordecai Breenberg and Six Jane and John Doe's, and they later renamed two of the Jane and John Doe's to Gordon Murray and Carol Moiseevich. As Brian pointed out, the original writ was all about the political positions of the defendants, although they claimed it was a trademark action. I just want to contrast this. Brian brought up the New York Times parody, which I'm not sure if any of you have seen. It's available online. They published 1.2 million copies of this, or so they say, and distributed them November 12th. 2008, talking about the Iraq War. The New York Times reaction was, April Fools came early. Their only complaint was that it wasn't as funny as a previous spoof edition that had been put out. So no lawsuits there. And Brian also alluded to the fact that the Canadian media hasn't covered our case. CBC, Toronto Star, National Post, none of them have covered it. The Globe and Mail, a tiny bit. Well, the New York Times parody was covered by the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the National Post, and CBC. And we tried to bring up the fact, and when the New York Times parody came out, we sent emails around to all kinds of media, mostly in the CBC, suggesting that a story could be done looking at these two parodies, the the Canadian homegrown one versus the New York Times one, compare, contrast, reaction, blah, blah, blah. Nobody touched it. But they did a 15-minute segment on a CBC National Arts Radio program, as Brian alluded to, Q, exclusively about the New York Times parody. On the issue of media chill, I just want to quote, there's an article in the Globe and Mail today about a defamation case before the Supreme Court of Canada. And, you know, I wanted to inject a little humor into this. So I thought I'd quote from Can West's lawyer, who says that the public benefits from a vigorous press that performs its watchdog and bloodhound role. Basically, this case is a defamation suit against the Can West newspaper, and they're saying, no, freedom of expression. And in fact, they're claiming the defense of responsible journalism. And their lawyer goes on to say, the defense of responsible journalism ought to be open to everyone, from bloggers to public interest groups that post damning comments on their website. It could just be a non-governmental organization that reports on atrocities somewhere, as long as it is in the public interest. And I'll add, and as long as it's not about Israel and Palestine. But that's a quote from me, not from their lawyer. this case does not occur in a vacuum. There is a concerted effort in Canada and internationally to squelch, to reduce, to limit the debate on Israel and Palestine. And I'll just mention a couple of examples. At McMaster University, when the students tried to organize an Israeli Apartheid Week event last year, the McMaster administration said you cannot use the words Israel and apartheid on a banner. In Victoria, the Peace Environment and Justice website, they reprinted an article from the Toronto Sun, which was originally titled "We should nuke Iran," but somebody went through and just changed Iran to Israel and in this article and just but included it verbatim. So it was said we should nuke Israel, and they've now been brought against the Human Rights Tribunal by B'nai B'rith because, according to B'nai B'rith, anything that compares Israel that says that Israel is an apartheid state is a hate crime. So there's lots of other people that are going to talk about other issues. So I just wanted to close with a quote, which was one of my favorites, from Edward Galeano. What is the use of writing if not to challenge the blockade imposed by the system on the dissenting message? That's why we did this parody, and that's why it's important to get this message out. Thank you.
And that was Gordon Murray. He was speaking at the Freedom of Speech Under Siege Forum held in Vancouver this week. And we're going to continue now with two more speakers from that forum. And the first of these is Deborah Campbell. She's an author and a journalist who specializes in writing on matters related to the Middle East.
I'm pleased to be here to speak today in defense of satire, which is one of really the last weapons in the arsenal of people against situations that are beyond their control. And because I'm a great fan of Jon Stewart, who's done so much with satire for so long. We're also talking about the siege on media freedom, which goes hand in hand with things like the siege on Gaza. Because when we talk about the Middle East, what we're talking about in a lot of ways is the parallel information war that's going on. What voices do we hear? What voices do we not hear? What perspectives are heard and which ones are silenced? I've spent the last 8 years or so covering the Middle East in countries from Palestine to Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Iran, And there's certainly a lot of difficulty in getting out stories about the Middle East generally, but it really, nothing really compares to doing stories on Palestine. So I thought I would talk a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes when you're doing this kind of journalism and what goes into it. So in 2002, I wrote a book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I had spent a lot of time living in the region. The book basically was motivated by the fact that in the early 90s, I was a student of Middle Eastern studies at Tel Aviv University. And in that time, in the years that passed, I had a lot of questions about the perspectives that were presented in my studies, and was very interested in exploring the perspectives that were not, certainly not taught in my classes, but also not part of the media that I was reading, not seen on the news and the radio and so on. So sometime in 2001, I decided to go about 10 years after my studies and write a book on the perspectives that I wasn't getting a chance to hear. So I went in with a lot of questions about that. And I wanted to write also a kind of kaleidoscope of views and not simply choose one perspective and write a kind of polemic. There's a lot of that out there. I'm not saying it's not useful, but it wasn't the kind of thing that I was hoping to do. So instead, I wanted to talk to Israelis that were, say, conscientious objectors to serving in the West Bank and Gaza. I wanted to talk also to the settlers themselves who were building settlements on Palestinian land and hear what they had to say in their own words. And strangely enough, they're so influential yet rarely quoted. Rarely do we get to hear what they actually have to say. And I wanted to hear the voices of average Palestinians living on the ground and get a chance to get close to their experience. A lot of the work that I do is immersive journalism where I go and live in places and stay there for months at a time. And live with people there, because it's my feeling that you can't really get a sense for what's happening with them unless you experience at least something of how they live. So whether it was sitting in their homes while Israeli tanks were firing on rock throwers in their early teens outside their homes, or spending time in Gaza while tanks were pointing their weapons at us as we were, you know, walking down the street. I got a much more close-up view of the conflict than I'd had either as a student, not very many kilometers away, or as certainly as a media viewer, media consumer. And I like to always say that I became a journalist because I don't want to rely on the press for information, and probably this is the one story where you least want to do that. So this book came out, and I was very pleased about it. And then I started noticing a strange phenomenon that started happening. And so I would have a big interview lined up with a major TV network, and it would be suddenly canceled. And then I'd get a call from an excited historian who was reviewing my book and was very excited about it for a major literary review. And then I'd get a sad little email from him a couple weeks later saying the editor had spiked it, and the editor had told him it had far too much attention already. So he was confused as to why she'd assigned him the review in the first place, but maybe she'd hoped it was going to be a really bad review. So then when I would be on television or the radio, the producers would invariably come up to me and say, we were so scared to have you on. And I started wondering, you know, why were you so frightened to have me on? I'm not particularly radical. I'm just presenting what I saw. I wrote kind of a literary documentary, and decidedly not a polemic for the reasons that I've said already. And it became apparent that it had a lot to do with the fact that I was telling human stories, first of all, about Palestinians, and that I was telling also about stories about Israelis that refused to go along with the occupation. It had a lot to say about what it was actually like to be a slave, for instance, a soldier, and fighting against civilians. And I was writing these kind of stories that we don't actually get to hear. So for me, because I believe in immersive journalism and personal up-close experience with the stories that I cover, this was a really valuable lesson for me as well, because it was you know, the subtitle of my book was Encounters in the Promised Land, and for me this was encounters with the media censorship around Palestine, and it was in a lot of ways a gift. It was a real education for me. And certainly I understood very clearly that I wasn't going to be able to find a place in Canadian media in terms of a nice staff job with, you know, health benefits and so on and so forth. But I also realized that I would never be able to do my work should I make that kind of agreement, because basically those kinds of stories just don't get published. And so I continued to do independent journalism and started working for Adbusters. And Adbusters quite happily hired me in part for the same reasons maybe that other people wouldn't. And I got a chance to do most of their Middle East coverage for about 4 years, and also write for bigger and bigger publications on issues like Iran, where I lived for 6 months, and also more recently covering the Iraqi refugees for magazines like Harper's. So in a lot of ways, it's been a great gift to be pushed outside of the corporate media that dominates the Canadian landscape, and to have to work internationally, and also to be able to do the kind of field research that I do. Basically, nobody's gonna send you out for 3 months or 6 months and let you, you know, really do the kind of immersive field research that I need to do to do the kind of in-depth work I want to do. No one's going to pay for it, and that's just a fact across the board in the corporate media right now. So most of my work has been for independent publications, although some of them are quite big independents, not say sort of smaller papers. And personally, for me, I think that one of the issues around people who cover Palestine is that a lot of them get forced into publications that nobody reads, or that they only are read by people who already know what they're talking about. The mainstream media is really important, because that's where 90% of people get their news. And a lot of us are getting our headline news too. I mean, what do we know about the financial crisis that we're getting outside of the mainstream media? They still have the resources, even if the roof is collapsing right now. So just to talk a little bit about coverage of the Gaza invasion that happened recently, I'll keep it very brief, but I think it's really important to understand the media strategy that went behind that. The UK and Israeli papers were commenting on how the media strategy was prepared 6 months before the invasion, and long before the context was set out that Hamas had done this or that, and it was their responsibility. The actual strategy was set forth, and I have a quote here, if I can find it, from Dan Gillerman, who was made the head of that PR strategy, where he commends the whole apparatus on working together to get the message out very effectively. And of course they did. So even, especially in the US and the UK, I was in Chicago and New York for most of the war, and so I spent a lot of time watching the US news, and pretty much point for point followed the Israeli talking points, such that, of course, Israel was the victim. And Israel was responding in self-defense, as the New York Times wrote in its editorial on December 29th, saying that Hamas must bear responsibility for ending a six-month ceasefire this month with a barrage of rockets into Israeli territory. Now, the paper of record, of course, had reported itself that the ceasefire was broken on November 4th by Israel. But, of course, November 4th was also the one day when nobody is really going to pay much attention because that was the day of the U.S. presidential election. So you can see how much thought goes into timing on these things.
That was Deborah Campbell. She's a journalist on the Middle East and author of the book This Heated Place, Encounters in the Promised Land. And the concluding speaker at the forum, Free Speech Under Siege, was Kimberly Baker. Kimberly is a Vancouver artist whose art incorporates social and political commentary, particularly on the 2010 Olympics. Here is Kimberly Baker.
I created a series of posters that engage with the issues of the impact of the Olympics on our city, such as what it's doing with the environment, packaging our city in visual terms in order to secure the bid. This one is packaging our city in terms of consumption for the tourist trade. And this one is on homelessness, which is one of the major issues, I think, with the Vancouver 2010 Olympics. Currently, there's 1,600 people that sleep on our streets every night. By 2010, there's going to be three times that amount. And this isn't just something that's being impacted in Vancouver. It's worldwide when these mega events come to cities. Internationally, there has been 2 million people in the last two decades displaced or homeless because of the Olympics. It's an amazing number. When I had first done these posters, it was just a mere coincidence. When they came out, so did the new copyright bill, C-47. So this bill is actually in accordance with the International Olympic Committee, and they have this requirement that any city that is accepted for the bid has to have this type of copyright legislation in place before they'll be allowed to host the Olympics. It gives the Vancouver 2010 Olympics an incredible amount of power over the visual images, text, anything associated with the Olympics. And it doesn't matter what configuration that I put it into, if I write out the words, whatnot, it's still any type of thing that is tied with Vancouver 2010 you're liable for. Now, within this bill, there's one point that says that except there's an exclusion for artists and parody, which is what I do. And but there isn't any definitions of what's legal and what's illegal. And so I was in quite a quandary of what to do at that point. So I thought, well, you know, trying to navigate my way through all of these legalities is not a strength of myself as an artist. So I went to three copyright specialists, and none of them could give me a definitive answer of if the art I was creating was illegal or not. So then I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll just go and make an appointment with Vanock, show them my artwork, and say, well, will you sue me? So
will you sue me?
Well, I must admit, truthfully, it took me a week to get up the nerve to phone them. And then it took me 3 weeks of perseverance to actually get an appointment. And so they sent down Colin Jarvis to talk with me, and he's the manager of commercial rights management with Vanock, and a very lovely man. He came and he spent a lot of time with me. So I talked with him about the challenges that were arising for me with this new copyright bill. So the complexity of the laws, and that I didn't really have an understanding of how far that they would go, and or how they sat alongside our Charter of Rights and Freedom of Expressions. So I asked him for some examples, and I said, okay, well, what if I decided that I wanted to create a mug, but I created one mug, and would that be okay with Vanock if I did that? And he said, yes, that would be all right, because you can do parody, and that's fine. And I said, but what if I wanted to make multiple mugs? He said, well, if you made that many mugs and you sold them for $5 each, and he said, well, that wouldn't be considered art anymore. No, you can't do that. So then I said, well, what if I wanted to make a T-shirt. And he said, well, one T-shirt might be okay, but what if I wanted to make several of them? He said, well, I don't think that would be all right. So, not again. I said, okay, well, what if I wanted to make a billboard? Well, I didn't even get away with one with that one. He said, if I made a billboard, in particular this one, and I placed it in the downtown east side, and then I made multiple ones of them, that they would look at that as I was running a campaign against them, and that was a no-go zone. Nope. So there we go. So I'm a street artist, I'm a social political artist, but I'm not allowed to put my artwork in the street. I'm not allowed to sell it. I'm not allowed to distribute it. So basically, I had gotten very good at describing what my artwork looks like without showing it. So you're all very lucky tonight. You actually get to see it. So I just didn't let it go at that point. The Common Ground magazine came out with a article, published an article about my little venturing through copyright land. And the main art gallery had a show with my work in it. And recently, 24 Hours published an article as well, showing my work. So there is quite a bit of support within the city on this issue. But what it actually ends up doing is that it makes this very difficult place because, one, you can't put your work in a gallery and sell it. Secondly, you can't have it on the street. 2 years ago, I tried to buy advertising space within the city during the Olympics. And it was put, the entire city's advertising space has been placed on hold. It even bypassed the sales reps. Vanock's saying that they've only purchased 80% of the advertising space during the Olympics, but I beg to differ on that because I couldn't get a billboard, everybody. Yeah. Next slide, please. This was the copy of the letter that they sent me afterwards. Didn't really outline anything of what I was allowed to do or not allowed to do, other than explaining that the copyright bill C-47 is about protecting them against ambush marketing. And ambush marketing is where a company would go in, create a whole bunch of T-shirts with the same logos and symbols and words as the Vancouver Town 2010 and then sell them. But my objective is to critique and to engage with the issues around the Vancouver 2010 Olympics. So what's recently I found that was really quite interesting is the new amendment that's been pushed through the Vancouver City Council, which is putting forth to the province that the city will have the right to come onto private property and move any signage or graffiti that they deem is illegal. And you can be fined $50 a day or up to $10,000 a day for repeat offenders. But within that amendment that I've read, that I have not been able to see what they deem is illegal. So, as many of the speakers tonight have said about shifting sands, there's no clarity, and these seems to be the ideas of what is illegal and what is legal has this pendulum, depending on what their whim is.
And that was artist and artographer Kimberly Baker. If you'd like to view some of the art she has created and that she referred to in her talk, you can visit her website. It's at kimberlybaker.ca. And the foregoing presentations were recorded at this week's Freedom of Speech Under Siege. It was a public forum, and it was organized by the Seriously Free Speech Committee. That committee works to raise awareness of the dangers of media concentration, and it advocates for a full and open discussion on issues of the Middle East. It was also organized to defend the three activists who were targeted by CanWest with a slap suit for the creation and distribution of a parody of the Vancouver Sun. The committee raises funds also for the legal costs of those advocates. To find out more about the committee, to donate towards their defense, you can visit the website, which is seriouslyfreespeech.ca.